Morning. Yeah. A couple weeks ago, my colleague and my dear friend, Dr. Matt LaGrange, delivered two what I think were excellent chapel presentations, in which he used the recurring metaphor of a stream or a pool as he spoke about the dynamic of how we come to grips with our stories. And in doing that, we open ourselves up to God's transforming power as he includes us inside his story. Today, I would like to invite you to reflect with me on a famous biblical narrative that also deals with a stream, a man who's coming to grips with himself and coming to grips with his God, who laid hold of him in order to transform his life and to transform our lives. It's the story of Yaakov as Yavaek at the Yavak. It even has got sound-alike words in the theme. Jacob as he wrestles at the Jabbok. We're going to be reading from Genesis 32, verses 22 through 32. Genesis 32, 22 through 32. That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Yaakov, be Jacob, but Yisrael, Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It's because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Jacob wrestles with God is usually the heading that appears above these sets of this set of verses in most English translations. But you know, Jacob's wrestling career had begun long before this time. Because we're told in Genesis 25:22 that when Isaac and Rebekah were pregnant, the twin boys, who would later be known as Jacob and Esau, wrestled. They tussled with each other inside Rebekah's womb. And although most English texts translate Yahweh's word to Rebekah concerning this phenomenon, saying, "The older will serve the younger," the Hebrew text actually uses terms that are more appropriate for athletics. Literally, Yahweh told Rebekah, "The big one will serve the little one. The big one will serve the little one." The story of Jacob stealing Esau's blessing in Genesis 27 also retains this big one and little one language. It doesn't really refer to Jacob and Esau as the younger and the older, as we see in most English translations, but rather refers to Esau as the greater or the bigger one, and to Jacob as his lesser, his katon, his smaller one. So there was the big guy and the little guy from the beginning. You know, the Perry Stepp and the Mark Halen. Okay, from the beginning. You know the story. You know the story. How the story goes on, and Jacob, as the boys get older, steals the birthright from Esau. Jacob's there with the, you know, cooking away at the lentil stew. Esau comes in from a hard day out in the field, and he thinks he's dying of hunger. And so Jacob takes advantage of the dumb redhead. We're told that Esau was red all over when he was born. Probably had red hair. Took advantage of a dumb redhead and stole the birthright. And then years pass, perhaps, months. We don't know exactly how long, but in the passage of time, Rebekah and Jacob schemed together to steal the blessing that belonged to Esau. It wasn't enough that Jacob had the birthright. Now he would go after the blessing. So Rebekah and Jacob scheme together. They take advantage of both Isaac and Esau. I find it interesting that in that story, when Rebekah suggests to Jacob what they can do to steal the blessing, Jacob's initial protest show that he's more concerned about getting caught, and after getting caught, getting cursed, then he is concerned about the inherent immorality of the whole scheme. He's perfectly okay with scheming. He's already demonstrated that. So Rebekah convinces him, and they go about their plot. He brings in the roasted goat. He's wrapped in goatskins to simulate his brother's hairy arms and neck. And then the blind Isaac asks a question, who is it? And at that point, Jacob is confronted with the question of his identity. Who is it? Who are you? Jacob answers, in effect, as an impersonator. He takes on the role of the firstborn as it is that he wishes he were someone else. And he says, I am Esau, your firstborn. He says that in chapter 27, verse 19. And then he falsely reassures Isaac once again in verse 24. It's as if Isaac gave him a chance to come clean. Isaac asks, are you really my son, Esau? So Jacob gained his brother's blessing, but in the process he lost himself. He gained something, but he lost who he was. He can't even name his own name to the question of, who are you? Esau, you know, discovers what happened. He vows to kill Jacob. Jacob then beats a hasty trail 500 miles northeast to their mother Rebekah's homeland under the guise of a lie. Where Rebekah says, you know, if Jacob would marry one of these, you know, Canaanite girls that Esau's married, I think I will die. So the scheming goes on. He gets to Paddan Aram, up in northeast Mesopotamia, near where Iraq, Syria, and Turkey come together on our maps. And he meets the lovely Rachel, daughter of Laban. Interestingly, in that encounter, the narrator portrays Jacob as once again avoiding the use of his own name. We read in 29:12, he told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. He finds out who she is, but kind of holds back on who he is, doesn't use his name. Now I know, in the real world, somewhere the name Jacob came up over the next 20 years. But the writer writes the text. The narrator tells us the story to demonstrate what's really going on with Jacob. Jacob doesn't use his name until the text that we read in chapter 32. He's avoiding himself for 20 years. He avoids himself. There in Paddan Aram, you review the story. He engages in an epic struggle with his father-in-law, the conjugal conniver Laban. You know, he hires himself out. Thank you, you appreciated that phrase. Okay, he hired himself out to Laban for 7 years for Rachel's hand in marriage, but was deceived on the wedding night. In exchange for being allowed to get his true love for a wife, he binds himself for an additional 7 years to Laban. And then things really get hairy there in Paddan Aram. Even Jacob's wives grapple with one another. They start competing with each other about childbirth. And what's really fascinating is that one of the children's name is Naphtali. One of the children of Leah is named Naphtali. And his name is based on a synonym of the verb wrestle that's used in Genesis 32. Leah gleefully announces at the birth of Naphtali, "With wrestlings of God, I have wrestled with my sister, and I've won." The wrestling goes on and on. For 20 years, Jacob and Laban match wits and cunning, trying to get the best of one another. Finally, Jacob wears out his welcome in the midst of this dysfunctional palooza, and he sets out on his way home to Canaan. In 31:55, it says, "Then he left and returned home." Then over in 33:16, it says, "They arrived." They were actually be 35:17. "Jacob, however, went to Succoth." So he left and he got there, but in between chapters 32 and 33, the narrator slows down the story. And we are given a glimpse into Jacob's life of an interesting encounter. Starts out at the beginning of chapter 32 that while Jacob was on his way, the angels of God met him in 32 verse 1. Now that's significant because when Jacob was running away from Esau in chapter 28 in Bethel, he was met by angels. So on his way out of Canaan, he was met by angels. On his way back, he was met by angels. So it appears that God is trying to reassure Jacob as he encounters these angels at Mahanaim. But Jacob anticipates a confrontation with Esau. After all, 20 years ago, the man said he's going to kill him. So what does he do? Well, he says, yeah, this is the camp of God in verse 2, but then in 32:3, Jacob himself sends messengers. Now what's really interesting, if you know a little Hebrew, then you catch this. The Hebrew word for angels is malakim. That's the same Hebrew word for messenger. Because there is no special word in the Bible for angels. There is no special word for dudes with wings and halos and white clothes. In both Hebrew and Greek, the word for angel, Greek angelos, from which we get angel, is just a word for messenger. God sent his messengers. I'm sure they probably look a little bit better than Jacob's messengers. But it's as if Jacob's saying, That's nice that God has sent me his messengers, but I'm going to get my own reconnaissance. I'm going to send my messengers. Well, then those messengers come back. They return with word that Esau's coming. Not only is Esau coming, he's coming with 400 men. This cannot be good. Afraid for his life, Jacob divides his company into two camps and sends presents ahead to appease his brother, because years earlier, he had vowed to kill him. So he's sending these presents. He's got his really great scheme working, by the way. He's saying, he tells the first messenger, when you come up to my brother, say, hey, this is a present from your brother Jacob. And then the second messenger's got a bunch of the cattle and livestock. When you see him, say, this is a present from your brother Jacob. And the idea is I just keep sending waves of presents. Maybe his heart will soften. So faced with what he feels is his imminent doom, Jacob does what a lot of us do when we're faced with trouble. He prayed. Verse 11 of chapter 32. Actually, let's start with verse 9. Jacob prayed, O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Yahweh who had said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I'll make you prosper. I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you've shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I've become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, I'll surely make you prosper, and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. Jacob gives as his most elemental and candid reason for his need for God to intervene on his behalf is simply, I am afraid. There's nothing hidden, nothing subtle here. Jacob accurately describes his situation because he accurately sees his situation. He sees it clearly. He's in touch both with his feelings and with his circumstances. He knows what the score is. Moreover, Jacob links his fear to an issue that we've already identified. As we saw, most English translations render verse 10 as Jacob describing himself as unworthy. The Hebrew text actually reads, I am too small. I am too small for these deeds of steadfast love that you have shown your servant. I'm afraid because I'm small. Now, Jacob had been afraid before. Hadn't he fled to Padan Aram to escape the wrath of his brother Esau because he feared? He'd been alone before. It was a 500-mile journey to Padan Aram. He evidently traveled it alone. But evidently something's different this time around. He's afraid and alone. But this time it's different because this time he realizes that his wits and his cunning are insufficient. He has no plan or resources beyond all the wealth that he's already sent ahead. What if that's not enough for Esau? He's got nothing left. What would become of him? What would become not only of him, but of Yahweh's promise to bless him that he had received 20 years earlier at Bethel? Jacob's words to Yahweh had said it all. He was too small. He was insufficient. He was afraid. He needed a savior. But it seems that Jacob isn't alone very long with these thoughts. Because suddenly, right there in the middle of verse 24, Jacob and we encounter an opponent. Where did he come from? I mean, you see that? It's like right after a comma, just a man showed up right after the comma there in verse 24. He appears suddenly, and the only thing more mysterious than his sudden appearance is his identity. Who was it? Let me suggest to you that the narrator, I believe this to be Moses, but the narrator, the storyteller, has decided at this point to tell us this story from Jacob's perspective. We figure out what is happening much like Jacob later figured it out. When it was all over, he knew that it had been a struggle with God. He called the place Peniel because he surmised that he'd been face to face with God. But he didn't know that at the beginning. When he first laid hands on the man and the man laid hands on him, he didn't know that was God. He merely thought he was struggling with a man who had fallen upon him during a dark night. In the ancient world, if you're out alone and you're on a trade route, you can get attacked by bandits. Probably just thought it was some bandit. But now as the night approached dawn, he became more and more aware of who his opponent was. Jacob came to realize that what at first appeared to be an encounter with and a struggle with a mere man was actually an encounter and a struggle with God. I would contend to you that that's the way it is with us many times. Often when God enters our life to challenge, to shape, or to transform us, he does so with us unawares that he's doing it. We think that our encounter is with a roommate, with a parent, with a professor, with an employer, with an employee, or with that irritating child in the after-school program where we work. But later we discover that that encounter had a divine dimension to it. Jesus said as much when he spoke of how believers would one day be totally mystified and stupefied to learn that the service that they rendered to one of the least of these would amount to encountering him and serving him. We might be amazed at our own answers if, and I challenge you to think about this tonight, when we lay down at night to sleep, if we asked ourselves, when, where, and how did I encounter God today? Through who did I encounter my Savior today? But if the first great head scratcher in this text is who was Jacob's opponent, the second one surfaces in verse 25. If this is God, after all, why can he not prevail over his own creature? That's a head scratcher. Well, again, perhaps verse 25 is written from Jacob's perspective. Jacob thought he had everything going pretty good. From where Jacob was standing, he thinks that he has fought his opponent to a draw. This fits the irony that follows, because at the moment of Jacob's seeming triumph, the opponent just kind of reaches out, touches Jacob, and Jacob is permanently injured. Just touches the hip, and it's out of socket forever. Jacob thought he had fought to a draw, but then, like that, not so. The hip is the wrestler's pivot point and the core of his strength. Jacob would not be able to receive Yahweh's blessing that he desperately wanted and he desperately needed until he became weak at the center of his human power. The American theologian and writer Frederick Buechner calls this event Jacob's magnificent defeat. Paul summarizes what Jacob is beginning to learn with his words in 2 Corinthians 12:10. For when I'm weak, then I am strong. God had deliberately made himself vulnerable to his own creature, struggling with him over time. For Jacob's entire life, Yahweh has been struggling with him, so that Jacob could come to know, and would come to know, that in his weakness and in his failing flesh, rather than in his own strength and ability, would be how he would become qualified to be the ancestor of the people of God. Now, if we eavesdrop into the components conversation, it reveals a whole lot about what's happening inside of Jacob and how the Lord works with us. Yahweh, despite what might have seemed to Jacob moments earlier, is ultimately in charge. God's got the upper hand through this whole thing. It's kind of like when you were little and maybe you played your dad out in the driveway, played basketball, and he was like kind of playing around with you, and you began to realize, this guy could beat me, at any game right now. He could pulverize me, but he's just kind of playing along with me. I think God's kind of playing along with Jacob. But then he wounded Jacob. And Jacob acknowledged that it's God who has the power to bless. And it's God who maintains the control of his name. Remember, at the end, God keeps his own name. Jacob doesn't have that power. It's kind of funny that later God will give his name at the burning bush to Jacob's descendants. Jacob, on the other hand, wants to be blessed. And God does bless him, but not before some unpleasant business is taken care of. And you may be asking, unpleasant? The opponent's question seems fairly innocent. What's so hairy about asking, what's your name? Well, most people in our culture name their children because the name sounds neat, or because someone famous had that same name. In ancient cultures, however, names were thought either to reveal character, or perhaps more significantly, to shape character. Jacob's name meant manipulator, schemer, conniver, and deceiver. That's what Yaakov means. One who holds the heel, one who uses other people for their own ends, a conniver, a schemer, a manipulator. He had lived up to that name. It was who he was. It's interesting that as the narrator tells Jacob's story up to this point, as we'd already talked about, he's given the opportunity for Jacob to give his name, but he has evaded it. This time, it's different. This time, Jacob comes to grips with who he was and with who he's been. It was an identity that had been foisted on him by other people. Did you ever think about that? His name meant conniver, manipulator, and deceiver, but he didn't name himself. He's got his mommy and his daddy to thank for that. They gave him that name, and he had lived up to it. Or should we say, he had lived down to it. But things change in verses 28 and 29. God blessed Jacob and gave him a new name and new identity. But the power of that new name and identity came at the cost of facing squarely his whole identity. And it's the same for you and me. God's wrestling with each one of us. He longs to release the power of his blessing on us, but we have to first admit to him that we know the score. We have to admit to him that we're too small. We have to admit to him that we have no capabilities to save ourselves, and we have to admit that we are afraid. We have to come clean with ourselves and with God about what's deep inside. For me, I grew up in a region considered by most people to be substandard. Poverty, undereducated, high unemployment, hick and redneck. People from other places consider people like us throwaways. People who aren't anybody and never amount to anything. That engendered in me an attitude I still have to struggle with. An attitude of I'll show you. I'll outperform you. I will outwork you. And I'll show you that I am significant. Stick it in your ear, buddy. But it's only when I came to realize many, many years ago that I was already significant in God's eyes and had nothing to prove to him or to anybody else that I could really sit back and enjoy the life, the blessings that I have in Christ and the calling that he placed on my life. I want to tell you, it's an awesome thing to wrestle with God. But it can be painful. If you want to be blessed, if you want to relocate from living in your own resources to resting in the middle of God's goodness, in the middle of his power and his provision, sometimes a little dislocation is necessary. Sometimes you got to get your hip out of joint. Just ask Jacob. You're dismissed.